We're talking about Old Testament theology as it pertains to God's mighty acts in history as they're described in the Old Testament. We just talked a little bit about the nature of the intersection between history and theological issues by comparing Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles. And now we're going to turn to the book of Exodus, specifically the first part of the book of Exodus, Exodus 1 to 18, which recounts the Exodus event itself, the exit from Egypt. And so what I'm going to do in this first session is talk about the Exodus as it's narrated in the book of Exodus and read it, think about it from an Old Testament perspective. And then in the next section, we'll look at it from the perspective of the New Testament and talk about how it points to Christ. So the story of the Exodus is, of course, well known, but let me emphasize certain parts of it as we turn to Exodus chapter 1. Now, you know, the Pentateuch is really one literary composition, and, you know, even bracketing the possibility that there might be a history of composition here. In its final form, it's one literary composition. Now, the book of Genesis is kind of like a prequel to what would have been considered the central story of the Pentateuch, which is the Exodus. And so as we turn to Exodus 1, there's been a chronological break of some centuries. We don't know exactly how many, how much time, but there are hooks back beginning in verse 1 back to the book of Genesis when it says, these are the names of the sons of Israel who went to Egypt with Jacob, each with his family, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher, the descendants of Jacob, numbered 70 in all. Joseph was already in Egypt. So it's referring back, of course, to the Joseph story, which is the final part of the book of Genesis that is the bridge that explains how Israel came to be in Egypt. Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died, but the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful. They multiplied greatly, increased in number, and became so numerous that the land was filled with them. So this language is hooking back both to Genesis 12, 1 through 3, and the promise to Abraham that his descendants will become a great nation, something which is spelled out later in the patriarchal narratives as your descendants will be as many as the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore, but also pointing back even to Genesis chapter 1 and the command to be fruitful and multiply. So even in slavery, God's promises are coming to fruition. But then verse 8, then a new king to whom Joseph meant nothing came to power in Egypt. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them or they will become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. So the Israelites are now perceived as a threat to the Pharaoh. Now, some historians point to the fact that previous to the Exodus, there was a 75-year period of time in the 16th century BC where a group of Semites known as the Hyksos came in and kind of took over Egypt. And as I say, that was for a period of 75 years before the Egyptians were able to kick them out and reestablish native Egyptian rule. And some people, and I think rightly, probably connect Egypt's new fear of Israel in their midst connected to the incursion of the Hyksos at an earlier period of time, because they're ethnic cousins, so to speak. You know, they're not that the Israelites were directly related to the Hyksos, but they were ethnically connected to them. So perhaps so, whatever, you have a new Pharaoh rise up. And I'm going to not address the issue of, you know, when did this take place? And there are debates among Bible-believing scholars as to whether it took place in the 15th century BC or the 13th century BC. We would have to spend at least an hour talking about all the archaeological textual issues connected to that. The question's raised, though, in the first place by the fact that the narrative doesn't ever mention the name of the pharaoh. It would all be easily resolved for our modern historical curiosity if it said something like Pharaoh Ramesses or, you know, Pharaoh Amenemope or whomever, you know. But Jim Hoffmeyer points out that what's going on here is that the biblical author is mimicking a practice of Egyptian historiography by not mentioning the enemy king by name and therefore not perpetuating the memory of that pharaoh. The Egyptians, when they write about their enemies, would never mention the name of the king that they fought. And so here Hoffmeyer says the Moses doesn't mention the pharaoh's name either. But it leaves us with a kind of a historical conundrum. My own view is that the predominance of the textual evidence leads to the 15th century BC, the earlier date, and the archaeology can be reread in a way that would conform to the 15th century date, though I'm not dogmatic about it. It could be 13th century, but as I say, I'm going to bracket that question because it's not directly relevant to our issue in Old Testament theology. But verse 11, so they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Pithom and Ramesses as store cities for Pharaoh. I can't, though, keep myself from saying the mention of Ramesses here might point some people to the 13th century, the later date, because that's when Pharaoh Ramesses lived. But I would also point out that you do have a phenomenon in the Pentateuch of updating geographical names. Just go back to Genesis 14, where there's the mention of the city of Dan, which wasn't named Dan until the time of the judges. It was earlier known as Laish. So again, it's not, doesn't confirm the 13th century date. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with harsh labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their harsh labor, the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shipra and Puah, and as kind of a side note, you know, it's not clear from the Hebrew whether they are themselves Hebrew midwives or whether they're midwives to the Hebrews. Indeed, in one Jewish interpretive tradition, these are the first righteous Gentiles, that is, Gentiles who help Jews when they're being persecuted. Their names, though, are Semitic and not Egyptian, Shipra and Puah. When you're helping the Hebrew women during childbirth on the delivery stool, if you see that the baby is a boy, kill him, but if it's a girl, let her live. The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. Then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, "Why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live?" The midwives answered Pharaoh, "Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They're vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive." Okay, so this raises an interesting ethical question that's been debated for centuries, and you could find people on both sides did the Egyptian midwives sin by lying to Pharaoh? Now, we talked earlier about the fact that the Hebrew narrator doesn't talk often explicitly about motivations. And the same thing can be said about evaluation, that in Hebrew storytelling, the narrator doesn't often intrude and simply say they did the right thing or what they did was wrong. But they do give signals as to, the narrator does give signals, and through the narrator, the author, as to what they feel about something like this. And I would submit to you that the very next verse, so God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. It's a pretty strong indication that God's saying, you know, go girls, kind of like this is you've done the right thing. And if you study deception in the Pentateuch, you'll see that that deception seems to be affirmed when it's in the interest of saving the people of God against those who want to persecute them. In other words, another way of thinking about it is, if the person asking for the truth, you know, is seeking the harm of the people of God, they forfeited the right to the truth. And it's like a warfare situation where you use deception in your military tactics and so forth. Well, as I say, it's a debated topic, but that would be my perspective on it. So then it goes, then Pharaoh gave this order to all the people, every Hebrew boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live. Well, it's not my purpose to go verse by verse through the Exodus story. As I say, it's a well-known story. In the next chapter, we learn about the birth of Moses. The birth of Moses is fraught with danger because of this fatwa, so to speak, on the part of Pharaoh, this command to kill all the baby boys. But the account of Moses' birth is dripping with ironic reversals. You know, the Pharaoh that wants all the baby boys to be killed, the one important future deliverer is actually raised in his own household. But it also raises an interesting question about how Moses' mother saves his life by putting him in a little basket, an ark, and floating him down the Nile River. What's going through her mind? Well, a lot of people don't know that we have an ancient Assyrian text that has a very similar story. It's called the Sargon birth legend. And Sargon was a ruler in Mesopotamia in the end of the third millennium. And it talks about how his mother, a high priestess, couldn't keep little baby Sargon. So she places him in a little basket, places the basket on the river Euphrates, and it's discovered by an irrigation ditch digger who raises Sargon as his own child. And so some people think, oh, you know, the Bible's just plagiarizing this Mesopotamian story. I would submit to you, and I studied this text as part of my dissertation back in the day, that that it's not a matter of, you know, plagiarizing this story. This is what women did who couldn't keep their babies for one reason or another, but wanted to commit their child into the hands of their God. In Moses' mother case, into the hands of God, to basically, please preserve my child, bring my child to a place of safety, which he indeed did. Kind of similar to stories you hear today about mothers who can't, or who feel like they can't keep their baby for one reason or another, putting it in a basket and putting it on the doorstep of a firehouse or something like that. We're all often too quick to say not we necessarily, but others are too quick to say that the Bible is kind of a ripoff of Mesopotamian or Egyptian literature. Though the study of those literatures are often very illuminating to us because it helps us recover that original context of the ancient Near East in which the Old Testament was originally written. But of course, then now the grown-up Moses is kills an Egyptian who's persecuting an Israelite worker, and he has to flee the country. And I'm, of course, running through the story real quickly, the familiar parts of the story, where he has an encounter with God who commissions him at the burning bush to return to Egypt and to free his people. Now, what I want to talk about, because this is something that I think a lot of readers miss in the Exodus story, is the fact that the plagues of Egypt are battles against the Egyptian gods. And that in the plague stories, we're to realize that the Egyptian gods exist and that they have some power. Now, I say this on the basis of Exodus 12, verse 12, where God announces on the eve of the Passover, he says, "On this night, I will have victory over the gods of Egypt." And indeed, I think those scholars who say that the plagues are tailored to attack specific Egyptian gods, I think that's correct. I mean, if you think about it from an Egyptian point of view, think about, say, the turning the waters of the Nile into blood. If you're an Egyptian, you know that the Nile is the source of all fertility in the land through its annual flooding. But you don't think of it just as a river. You think of it connected to a god named Hapi. And Hapi's the god of the Nile. And one morning you wake up and the Nile is blood. You say, "What did they do to Hapi?" You know, Hapi's been attacked. Or a second example would be the plague, the ninth plague, you know, when the sun goes dark. If you're an Egyptian, your most important god is the god of the sun, who is thought to, you know, get on his chariot and go through the sky every day, descend into the underworld, fight the god of chaos, Apophis, rise up again. But in the middle of a day, all of a sudden the sun goes dark. That would be an attack against the sun god, who goes by various names like Ptah or Aten or Ra. And even the final plague, the plague, the death of the firstborn, would be an attack against Pharaoh's household, Pharaoh being a god man. So as I say, the plagues are attacks against the Egyptian gods, ultimately against Pharaoh himself. And they have some power at the beginning. They have the Egyptian wise men are able to turn water into blood. They're able, you know, their staffs turn into snakes. They don't have comparable power to God. So what are we to think about that, since we also know that the Bible insists on the fact that there's only one God, capital G? Why is it that in the plague narratives and elsewhere in Scripture, Psalm 82, and we could look at some other passages, seem to talk about the gods as if they exist? Well, I simply submit to you that sometimes the Old Testament uses the term Elohim to refer to all spiritual beings, whether created or the one uncreated spiritual being. In other words, sometimes gods is used to refer to what we and other scriptures will refer to as angels and demons. So who are the Egyptian gods? Well, the Egyptian gods are demonic powers that are worshipped by the Egyptians as if they are the true gods, but of course they're not. Well, in any case, after the final plague, the Egyptians allow the Israelites to leave, and as they do, and this will become important later in the course, they're given wealth, gold, silver, and other precious materials. However, it's not the end, because after they leave, Pharaoh has a change of heart and now wants to attack the Israelites. And interesting, if you turn to Exodus chapter 14, it's interesting to realize that, you know, the Israelites have already gone beyond the Yom Suf. And we could discuss exactly where the Yom Suf is. Yom Suf in Hebrew means Sea of Reeds. There's no debating about that. It's just some people think the Sea of Reeds is the Red Sea, and some people think the Yom Suf or the Sea of Reeds is a freshwater lake north of a lake that used to exist north of the Gulf of Suez. Whatever it is, it's an impassable body of water. I'm not arguing that it's a little shallow area that wind can blow away and they can wade through quickly. No, there's no doubt from the biblical story that this is an amazing, extraordinary providence that allows them to escape. But notice they're already beyond the Yom Suf. And God says in verse 2, tell the Israelites to turn back and encamp near Pi Hahiroth between Migdol and the sea. They're to encamp by the sea directly opposite Baal Zephon. Pharaoh will think the Israelites are wandering around the land in confusion, hemmed in by the desert, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart and he will pursue them. But I will gain glory for myself through Pharaoh and all his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord. So the Israelites did this. Pharaoh thinks he's in control, but God is really in control. And he's in control in a way that will demonstrate his glory. And how is his glory demonstrated? It's through the judgment brought on Pharaoh and the Egyptians. Pharaoh, who thinks he's God, but is about to learn that he's not. So when we come to the crossing of the Yom Suf, we're coming to the salvation event par excellence in the Old Testament. And when we come to the next section, we're going to see that this salvation event reverberates throughout the Old Testament and into the New Testament.